Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. You know, as a book fiend, books are very lively things for me. They encode memories. They can be people. They can be characters in my dreams. And they can also serve as ways of understanding and relating to people that I meet, in the sense that sometimes there are books that become the repository of relationships and recognitions, which I think is a wonderful way to experience other people as well as the magic of books. And our guest today is Baron Scott Levkoff, who I've had the privilege of knowing for many, many years. And he's someone who I understood better once I read a book that we are both extremely big fans of, which I'm going to now pass on to you. The name of the book is The Death and Resurrection Show by Rogan Taylor. And unfortunately, it is a rather pricey item. It was, I think, never reprinted. It's from the 70s, where so many wonderful books are from. But it is worth tracking down in whatever manner you have, because it tells a story more succinctly, entertainingly, and convincingly than I have really found in any other source around similar materials. And it's one that really changed my view of what we do culturally, what entertainment is about. And basically, he goes through, he's an anthropologist and a historian, and he talks about the history of or what lies behind a lot of modern entertainment forms, the magic show, the sideshow circus, Commedia dell'arte, Punch and Judy, the sort of, you know, the kinds of things that have come up in the last couple centuries. And he just shows how directly these modern forms evolved and emerged from essentially shamanism, not just earlier rituals of entertainment or ecstasy or even the theater of, let's say, the ancient Greeks and their Dionysian theatrical displays, but really taking it back to the basic frameworks and models of shamanism, the idea of a death and resurrection show, that partly what you do when you're witnessing a shaman going through his or her transformative journey, and sometimes taking it with them, is precisely going through this classic death rebirth scenario, which, you know, in its original context is also performed with instruments and costumes and lighting and all sorts of elements that help people enter an altered state, a transformative state, and that many of these techniques, tricks, etc., can also be found in modern forms. And, you know, you could think about this in a secular way. A lot of people do, where you're saying, well, you look back at the old shaman rituals and you say, oh, they're basically just performers. They're entertaining the crowd. They're providing additional symbolic meanings. They're helping people deal with the chaos of their lives by reinforcing social stories, which is what our entertainers do today. But you can just as easily put on your mystic hat, your traveler's full garb, your sort of godlike eyes, and see the opposite, and that see even in some of our more coarse and crude 20th century arts sort of glimmerings of an more ancient shamanic worldview. And to me, that's a much more entertaining way of approaching things, particularly when you deal with performers and worlds like Scott Levkoff's, where the exuberance around costume, revelry, magic, sideshow, burlesque, this sort of like tantalizing edge of a proper entertainment is infused with a certain kind of magic and potential for transformation. And it's as such, it comes out of and relates to a lot of other currents we've talked about on the show, Burning Man, transformations in sex positive culture, the uncanny cultural currents that animate our era. So I really look forward to our conversation and hearing about the Halloween extravaganza. Scott, who I think of as the professor or Professor Violet, is preparing for those lucky enough to be in the San Francisco Bay Area. But before we bring him on, I'd like to introduce, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's going great. And, you know, I'm wondering, October's probably one of your favorite months.
It is.
And I'm curious, do you already have your, like, Halloween weekend lined up?
I do. For witches, it's a very busy time of year, as you can imagine. We got to, you know, get our cauldrons going and all of that. On Halloween proper, I'm actually going to be doing a seance. It's similar. I did one last Halloween as well with a medium that I work with named Ada McDonald. And it was crazy. I wrote about it on my blog. We had nutso things happen. We were naming names, man. So it was good. I'm looking forward to it.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's it's the time for the spirits. I realized last Halloween, it was really funny. It just happened to be I was at some time in the afternoon. It was right around. It wasn't on Halloween Day. It was the day before, the day after, or something like that. And I was just like, I suddenly had this urge to like go through my files and find all this material that my grandfather, who had died a decade before, had written. And I just sort of found myself like reading through this material and looking at photographs of him. And then I just kind of flashed and I went, shit, it's like we're near All Souls, man. The veils are thin and the spirits are about. And I really do believe it is a special time of year.
People forget Halloween's origin was about ghosts and the dead, like the Day of the Dead. I think a lot of people, you know, everyone's all into the candy and costumes, but they forget it's absolutely a death day. So it's important, I think, on those days to, you know, reconnect with the ancestors, get into that kind of thing, go back in the history and kind of do those sorts of things around that time.
Yeah, well, I'm sure our guests will agree. So let's bring Scott onto the show. Scott, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
You bet. Great to be on, Eric.
Yes. Well, why don't we start out? Why don't you tell me a little bit about the speakeasy and then or the spookeasy, excuse me, and then we can kind of dial it back and get some of the background information, because it's a really cool event. It's not like anything I've quite heard about. It combines a lot of different elements, and it's very you. So I'm really excited about it, and I'd like to hear some about it.
Absolutely. The opportunity showed up about a month ago. The Great Star Theater, which is a historic vaudeville house built in 1923 right there in Chinatown on the edge of North Beach in Chinatown, approached me and said they had a date available. They had Halloween weekend. And immediately my imagination just went nuts. I was like, oh, boy, because I love Halloween. I've always loved Halloween on many levels and for many reasons. And the opportunity was just so ripe. I was like, okay, 2 months, yeah, let's do this. So, you know, the Muse and, of course, Mr. Nobody, who you'll find out more about in a second, they came up with Spookeasy. And Spookeasy is essentially a kind of an adventure, a shamanic journey into the cartoon underworld, as I've called it for some folks. And it starts out with a cocktail party where you enter a haunted Chinatown theater and strolling ghosts and kind of come up to you, and you slowly find out more as you interact with ghosts what happened with the great tragedy of 1932. And then there's a show, a full vaudeville stage show with integrated burlesque, vaudeville, and a lot of large-scale projection and puppet techniques. And that show's about an hour and a half. And then we go straight into the afterlife dance party in the cartoon underworld. People can come on stage, dance, and we have the Masters of Electro Swing from Trapeze, the Clown and Aaron Delishaw spinning, and with some live musical accompaniment. And so people can dance and wander and explore the haunted theater until the wee hours. And so it's kind of a multi-part journey.
It sounds super wonderful. I mean, one of the things that really came through for me that made it special is the way that you're very much locating it in a particular time and place. I mean, there's a tendency, I think, in the Halloween mode and even in haunted houses or whatever, just to kind of grab from the sort of grab bag of all the sort of classic sites of spooky things or monsters or whatever. But this is very located in a particular theater, in a particular city, with a particular kind of historical background. And for me, that always amplifies the sense of the proximity to the uncanny when it's really located in the history of the place. Because then it's like the ghosts are, for me, partly woven into the history. They're not just sort of abstract entities that come out of anywhere. They come out of particular places in particular times. So what is it about this place and this time that's appealing to you?
A couple things. One, I'm really kind of tired of, like, sort of torture porn shock gore in your face, you know, chainsaws cutting up flesh, kind of, you know, Halloween stuff. I'm just over it. I wanted to create something that has sort of an innocence to it a little bit, in terms of, like, it's like fun to get scared. So really attracted to the early 30s and bringing, you know, exploring the kind of the ambiance and the history of the theater being built in 1923, thinking about what would be an interesting period to attack. And working with my collaborator, head writer Sean Owens, who's an incredible talent, and Jasper Patterson, who's kind of heading up the vaudeville element, we really kind of came to the fact that the early 30s was a really interesting time because radio and, you know, television wasn't far off, but radio was kind of killing off vaudeville a little bit. Vaudeville houses were struggling, and a lot of these places became movie theaters, you know, in years to come. So we thought, what an interesting time in history to explore in San Francisco, to explore kind of the mythology and the characters and storylines of the day. So the story, as it's kind of like coming out, is very much based on the time and place and the feel of Prohibition era. And the themes of the Dust Bowl, themes of the Great Depression, the Wall Street crash right there in 29, you know, and Prohibition finally ended, I think, in 33. So 32 is kind of like the final years where there's like all this kind of really intense stuff going on. We thought, that's an interesting time in history. And the music, of course, was going from ragtime into more like traditional jazz. Duke Ellington was just starting up, and big band was kind of on the rise. And there's like this kind of hot, saucy jazz that happened right around that time, and that's the music that's going to be you're going to be hearing in this event. And it's a really wonderful sound as well. So
it's also kind of, there's an interesting spookiness about it, even though it's very lively. You hear there's something about the melodies and the weird intensity of ragtime. It carries some kind of or New Orleans jazz that gets transformed into big band. It has this sort of spooky, scratchy cartoon quality, and I really love the way you talk about the cartoon as a mode of the underground and the underworld. And it's not just as a way to make it more fun and playful and less, you know, kind of morbid, but there's also something about cartoons, and particularly old cartoons, where there's a haunted quality to them. I think of those, like you mentioned in the notes for the event, like Max Fleischer cartoons, and there's something about the kind of bouncing, scratchy animation, like they're alive with something, but it's alive with something that's kind of spooky, even if they're fun.
Absolutely. There's a few in particular that we're really basing a lot of routines and acts in the show on. One of them is Max Fleischer's Swing You Sinners, and it was based on the song Sing You Sinners, and it's just sort of a total psychedelic voyage of this, like, sinning cat into the graveyard kind of haunted world. Just really beautiful imagery. The music's haunting. There's another one called Bimbo's Initiation, which is sort of a take on the initiatory kind of ceremonies of the fraternal orders of the time. And we're bringing to life some of those scenes that you see in both of those cartoons. And they're just really rich inspiration. And we're really excited to be honoring and bringing these back to life a little
bit. Yeah. And isn't that Bimbo's Initiation? That's a Betty Boop cartoon, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, she goes down in there. Want to be a member?
Want to be a member? That's another thing that I think, and I'm sure you've thought about this as well, is there's a whole side of the fraternal orders from the late 19th century to the period that you're coming from with the Spookeasy, where, I mean, we don't people talk about Masonry now and the Illuminati and da-da-da and the Freemasons and blah, blah, blah. But at that period of time, every male was, even in Podunk, cow towns in Iowa, people were in fraternal orders. There were just tons and tons of fraternal orders. And a lot of them were kind of goofy. Like they mixed the sort of esoteric, hierarchical, hieratic view of a Masonic ceremony with like all sorts of gimmicks and goofy things and riding the goat. And there's this whole weird, like spooky, goofy Americana entertainment current that's incredibly rich. And that even in our era now, where there's a lot of burlesque, there's a lot of attention to this era in some ways, I feel that the kind of esoteric potential of it remains a little untapped. I suspect you have a similar perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the primary activity of a lot of these organizations, 70% of all adult men in the United States for almost a period of 150 years, I think, were involved with some sort of these fraternal orders, and the primary activity was an initiatory ritual. The primary activity being these rituals that they would go through to become a member, and then they have a sense of belonging, and they share resources and a sense of fraternity and support. But the experience of initiation and ritual was something that was so deep in these experiences for these folks. And I know I long for it. I'm always looking for ritual, and I know a lot of folks that love, they love going to the playa and all sorts of things because they long for ritual. They long for an experience, And I thought, well, Halloween, if it's a time to, commune with the past and the ancestors and, to kind of talk and access the veil between the worlds, let's do it in a way with intention. And, let's create a ritual so that we can have fun and we can celebrate, but there's a sense of purpose, in the show. Without giving too much away and going too deep, the experience for the guests at Spookeasy is very much an initiatory ritual of going into the cartoon underworld, as I call it. Just underworld sounds a little scary, right? Cartoon underworld, where they finally meet Mr. Nobody, and at the finale, they embrace their fears. And indeed, without the audience's help, the ghosts that are trapped in the vaudeville house cannot be free to move on, unless the guests themselves offer up a gift of a fear that they name and they release. And Mr. Nobody, he eats fear. That's his role. He eats fear. The guests offer that up. We all have this moment where we've gone into the underworld together. We've offered our fear up, and then we celebrate.
Well, I know in your own, it sounds wonderful, but I know in your own sort of personal and professional journey, you've developed a lot of characters, like recurring figures that you will dress up as. I mean, you're a remarkable costumer, but also there are sort of figures you're kind of engaging in a more traditional way in some regard, and you have that mixture. So talk a little bit about Mr. Nobody and the whole and what that character is about and what lies behind it.
Well, Mr. Nobody is kind of an artistic version of my relationship with Baron Samedi. Now, mind you, I'm not an initiated voodoo practitioner by any means. I mean, I'm a carny shaman. You think about the word shaman and showman, right? That the Death and Resurrection show goes into that relationship. I'm very much an eclectic dilettante practitioner, but as an artist, you do what you do. I don't ask for permission. Like, I'm an artist, and this character Baron Samedi, the skull-faced, top-hat, cigar-wearing, joke-cracking kind of trickster character that appears in the pantheon of the Voodoo Loa, he showed up to me when I was in college, and I would see him everywhere, and it was just a relationship that just sort of emerged, and I started creating puppet versions of him. I would start dressing up, and When you know, my old partner and I, Polly, went out to produce a show in New Orleans many years ago, my relationship really deepened, and I realized the power that working with some of these archetypes or allies or spirits or whatever you want to call them have for artists and folks doing kind of like live, really intense events that I do. So Baron Samedi, you know, he's kind of been with me, and then he became Mr. Nobody in my project, The Mystic Midway. And he started to take on a life of his own, and he shows up in these experiences that I've facilitated with these different events. And Mr. Nobody would always show up, very much like Baron Samedi does in the voodoo rituals. Baron Samedi is the one character that, one of the Loas, that you don't actually invoke. He just kind of shows up when he wants to. And in that regard, Mr. Nobody shows up in the Mystic Midway experiences that I would facilitate, kind of this kind of a role-playing theatrical journeys that I would take people on. And Mr. Nobody shows up when fear kind of presents itself, and suddenly somebody's gripped with like a fear of like, oh, I'm not good enough, or I'm not creative enough, or this is holding me back, or I'm afraid of, you know, failure or success. And Mr. Nobody would show up, and we would all engage in a space where it wouldn't even be me. Somebody would play Mr. Nobody. And it's like, okay, what is your fear? What do you want to offer to him? And then Mr. Nobody would take the fear and literally motion, be putting it in his mouth and consuming the fear. He went on to show up in a box truck theatrical kind of presentation at a night market that we did here a couple years ago. And we had a experience where guests waited in line outside of a box truck, and we created a swamp shack environment in the truck, blacklight environment, where guests could come in, sit down, and then together go on a kind of a little journey of offering their fear up to Mr. Nobody. We had Wesley Morgan playing swamp noir music. It was all beautiful candles and symbols everywhere, and it was a really fun, kind of surprisingly powerful experience, especially for me. And realizing, like, this is really, people are really getting something out of this. And I was like, yay, excellent.
Have you ever had Mr. Nobody show up when it was not in theatrical auspices? Like, as in, like, for you personally, as a result of doing any of those rituals, have you had anything kind of seep into, across the border, into other areas?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he very much communicates with me, and I talk to him. He's a muse, you know, and he's one of my main allies, and he'll constantly show up. I'll feel his presence. He'll kind of, you know, speak to me the way the muse does, and especially with this production of Spookeasy, it's the largest show I've ever produced. It's absolutely terrifying, and he'll keep showing up. He's like, give me the fear. What are you afraid of? Give me your fear. I mean, I could not be doing this production without his constant guidance and support.
You know, I really love it. There's a phrase you have in one of your articles of cosplay shamanism, and it really captures this sort of weird zone where we're not in a traditional framework. You're not a traditional voodoo initiate. You're not, you know, you don't have a Santeria house that you turn to. And yet there is an authenticity and a sort of openness to the weird that takes it much beyond a kind of merely costume, merely performative show. But that middle space is very tricky. It's a very weird zone. I mean, how do you feel like someone who was maybe more traditionally oriented might go, you can't do that stuff. You can't really legitimately invoke these things. You need to go through the traditional structures and this is just appropriation, blah, blah, blah. But clearly it's something that's very authentic for you and for a lot of people. And I think it is actually lurking behind a lot of what people want when they put on costumes and when they play this way. So what in your own experience or your own life path sort of gave you the encouragement or the affirmation that, yeah, you can do it this way. You can create your own sorts of relationships with these imaginative others that become more than imagination. How did you find yourself being able to negotiate that sort of tricky space?
Gosh, yeah, that's a question, isn't it? Something
that's
really
what they pay me for.
Very private you know, and something I've been kind of coming out more about, my practice of cosplay shamanism, you know, as we call it. You know, I got to say, you know, having supportive parents, you know, that was a start. They're just like, hey, do what you want. Just be happy. Just as long as you're happy, do what you want. You know, and I was a very precocious child reading and very much involved and immersed in imagination and books and role-playing. You know, role-playing was a big part of it for me back in high school, you know. And then I very much got into college. I encountered the Death and Resurrection Show, that book, and also another book called The Theater of the Marvelous, Surrealism in the Contemporary Stage by Gloria Orenstein. Those two books were very pivotal for inspiring me on the path of exploring the world of myth and archetype and shamanism and the role that shamanism plays in modern-day society and its relationship to the tradition of popular entertainment, as it's called, which is encompasses street fairs and festivals, seasonal fairs and celebrations, pagan festivals. You know, Dia de los Muertos is a type of a popular entertainment in some ways in the way that it's celebrated, but it's also acknowledging deep connection to the earth, to ancestors, to lineage, you know, and then being involved at the Santo Daime Church and exploring psychedelic shamanism back in the 90s, and then theatrical role play, and then producing events, you know, thousands of events, and working as an entertainer and putting on the mask, putting on the fool's motley, you know, putting on these costumes and surrendering myself to the characters that would come through me, you know, over my career, has taught me how to increasingly work with these kind of, I don't know, you know, are they thought forms? Are they spirits? Are they muses? You know, what are they? Ultimately, I'm an artist, and I don't really need to understand. My desire is to help other people to tune in to their mythic selves, their authentic, you know, dreamtime skins, as you once said, Eric, which I love that term, dreamtime skin, so that they can live more fully in this life. You know, a lot of what I do is dedicated to helping folks learn how to play and then to embody these mythic selves. And if that means by communicating with Peter Pan or, you know, Tinkerbell or the Green Man or Kali or Baron Samedi, you know, so be it. It's all kind of art to me.
Yeah, it reminds me of something I read recently online. I can't remember where the article was. Was it in Vice? About the latest thing, tulpamancy. And it was an article about people who were not considering themselves magicians in the occultist sense of the term. They were not esoteric people in that sense, but they were aware of creating a relationship with an entity that was, they considered it to be separate from them, that had their own lives, that had their own responses, and were learning how to communicate with these tulpas. The term is, you know, from Tibetan popular religion, is filtered through, you know, Western ideas about magic. And it was very interesting because the people, you know, a lot of the entities were sort of, in a way, more similar to cosplay and the kind of fantasy fandom world than they were from like traditional archetypes, but they clearly still had an archetypal character and behaved to these people as sort of animated entities. And it really was quite illuminating, because even if it's only like a very small subculture of people doing this, it points to the way that there's some space in between you know even avant-garde esotericism and occultism and popular fan fiction and the kind of world of the mediated imagination through science fiction and fantasy and role-playing games and things, that there's a space in between, though, that's neither. It's something where there's some sort of animation happening, but in a way you can almost no longer think about it in traditional terms. And it feels like you have been approaching and working, playing with that space in a performance context for a long time. Do you think that the whole nature of these archetypes and imagos and sort of entities is shifting now because of the way things are changing with media and fandom? Or are they just sort of always there finding their own way into human culture?
Well, you know, it's been interesting watching the cosplay movement, you know, because you look at what's going on. They're not just putting on costumes. You know, they're really stepping in to permission, because that's what a lot of this is about. Like, you know, society, you know, industrial society that says you have to be a worker in a cog doing this thing to make your money, to buy your crap. It's like it doesn't serve our infinite potential as human beings. So I think consciousness and culture is evolving to give us permission to become who we're destined to be, which is unlimited, you know, and these amazing, embodied, super creative, loving, compassionate, problem-solving creatures. And I think if there's, you know, ever a better time for us to really step it up, it seems like it's now. You know, so.
Well, and so let me just ask you this to play the devil's advocate, because there's a large percent of the population that believes engaging in those activities is actually dangerous, right? And that's like a big part of why it's become taboo. So to actually get mounted or do some of those practices to allow an archetype to possess you, there's a lot of folks that that is like, right, it's bad news bears. So, I mean, how do you kind of bridge that gap for the difference of people who feel like it's so naughty and the difference of, like, being able to attain liberation and freedom? Like, do you feel like it's just people are so brainwashed from being the cog in the culture and they can't see past it? Or what? I know that's, like, a big question, but do you, in your thoughts, have you, like, kind of, like, made an answer for that? Do you just feel like they're wrong, or it's just whatever floats your boat? Or what do you kind of think about that?
Gosh, yeah, it's a really interesting question, you know. I mean, in voodoo practice, there's a loa called the Master of the Head who invites you to not be ridden without purpose and intention. It's like, don't just surrender yourself. I don't just give myself over. I'm not a puppet. You know, I'm not some puppet to some otherworldly forces. That's not what's going on here. I'm an artist, and I'm collaborating with these creative forces to be able to bring more good into the world and to be more who I feel I am destined to be in this world. You know, I mean, obviously people are going to be afraid of this kind of stuff because it looks like you're opening yourself up to God knows what, right? And if you live in a world of fear, you're just going to see it as like, oh, whoa, 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 you know. And, you know, as an event producer and somebody that's produced events, I've seen people being ridden all the time. I see people literally being torn apart by Dionysian forces, right? I mean, that cult of Bacchus, they party themselves out of existence because they were ridden so hard by the spirits that they tore themselves apart. You know, and it's definitely exists. I think, you know, by embracing this stuff with advocacy and intelligence and heart and compassion and creativity and awareness and consent and respect, I think we can learn how to kind of harness these kinds of relationships, you know, more effectively.
That's a wonderful answer. But we got to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with the Baron, the Professor, Mr. Nobody, Scott Levkoff, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back, guys. This is Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Scott Levkoff about getting mounted. So we are talking a little bit about those shamanic performance aspects and how by doing performances with these archetypes, we can possibly, hopefully, have a potential at least to evolve as human beings and explore, you know, what we're kind of capable of. So I've always enjoyed reading about performance and shamanism, because if you think about people, it's so monkey see, monkey do, right? Like, people see stuff and they just copy it, basically. Like, you any band, right? You have the Ramones play, suddenly everyone's dressing like the Ramones. They want to be the person that they saw. You have movies, everyone just kind of relive stories and movies in their life because they think that's like what they're supposed to do. So do you think that because people innately kind of have this capacity to just take on these things that we see, that if you use these kind of performances in an intentful way, like you mentioned, like with, you know, purpose, and kind of being that way, that if we tried to make people monkey see, monkey do, things that were like, you know, what the gods do or what these myths are, instead of maybe, say, Monday Night Football, right? Do you think, like, I mean, what kind of impact do you think that would have on society if people could participate in larger levels with better stories to emulate?
Well, we're looking at wide-scale transformation of culture. You know, I mean, you're talking about mirror neurons, right? And if society can operate, you know, and look at the way that media is, social media is spreading, it's their mirror neurons are establishing
right.
themselves as a giant mirror network, and everybody's watching everybody else to see how they're behaving and what they're doing and what's the effect that it's having, right?
Right, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, I do. It seems like if we can get people's eyeballs focused on things like that, then it could, I mean, you'd think it could potentially shift in a rather large manner than if people's eyeballs are only consuming, like, just garbaggio, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So before you talked about you know, some of your influences growing up, and I'd like to push you a little bit on talking about the relatively unusual situation you had growing up in terms of the kind of context you were living in, particularly
yeah.
as it related to this sort of imaginal other world and the way in which these things could be really quite powerful.
Yeah, well, it's interesting having, you know, sort of hippie-esque parents. They introduced me to a lot of amazing folks, you know. I mean, I sat in satsang with Satchitananda, you know, front row, and he came up and grabbed my head and laughed and shook me. And, you know, I don't know, I guess as a kid you remember these things. It affects you, you know. You know, so stuff like that, you know. But just very much immersed in literature and fantasy literature and being a very shy child. And just really giving myself into that, it was my escape, and I just lived in my fantasy world. And I don't know, at some point at all, I realized I was like, oh, as an event producer and a performer, I can actually inhabit these worlds. And I just, over the years, started finding myself increasingly creating these worlds for other people to come in, and people love to be able to, you know, dress up, play somebody else for the evening, or, you know, explore an aspect of their personality. And it was all very much an exploration and an experiment, and it still is, you know, but I started noticing it had effect. People would try on a different hat, a different dress, a different persona for the night, and they would have a profound transformation. They're like, oh, wow, like I got out of myself. I gave myself permission to try something else out, a different skin on for the night. And then you see permanent change occur.
Yeah,
and it's been the same for me. I mean,
along these lines, let's talk a little bit about the experiments that you've had in trying to encourage this. Because one of the difficulties, as you well know, is that you throw an event, you provide the opportunity for people who are, you know, paying customers to participate in various ways, but it's difficult to do because unless you are used to a culture of radical participation, you tend to sort of fall back on being a spectator. And, you know, even to get people, like, I know your spookies, you really encourage people to wear, you know, period garb or roughly period garb. And
Absolutely.
In a place like San Francisco, that's not too much to ask because there's a widespread culture of costuming here. But even beyond the clothes, you know, things get kind of tricky because it's the more elaborate, the more you're asking from participants, then the higher bar it is for them. Like, do I want to do this? It's kind of scary. What are they asking me to do? And I know you've wrestled with that and worked out different ways to do that, particularly through the Mystic Midway and your idea and your earlier idea of Superstar Avatar as ways to kind of gamify this encouragement for people to experiment and explore other personalities. So I'd love to hear you reflect on some of the challenges and some of the breakthroughs you've had in terms of encouraging people who aren't necessarily coming there for a ritual, but have the potential and are curious about going a little bit farther than just being another consumer of another spectacle.
Yeah, it's been a real collaborative process, and a lot of the amazing people that I've been working and playing with have taught me a lot about this. A lot of what we're talking about, like for myself as a director, is really about listening and noticing and tuning in to what kind of aspects or qualities are the folks that I'm playing with and working with, what do they bring to the table? And like really asking them, like, what's up for them? Like, what are they attracted to? What are they passionate about? What kind of characters or allies or themes are really present in their life? And then using that as the sort of the inroads to explore what kinds of roles or characters or themes they want to bring to the table. The Mystic Midway has really been informed by my collaboration with a group of really amazing people that have really helped me to learn how to listen, to ask better questions, and to, you know, tune into a process that allows us all to sort of kind of co-navigate that process together, you know, rather than it being a top-down hierarchical process. And now with the director that I'm assistant director, this fellow Sean Owens, he's working very much in a similar way. I mean, because I said, hey, Sean, like, we're going to have these strolling characters at Spookeasy. We don't want to just tell them what to do. Like, let's ask them some real penetrating questions, and specifically, what fears are they up against, or what kind of fears are they facing in their life, and how can we as directors kind of support our cast of strolling characters in exploring these themes on a personal level, so we can weave that into the character, their ghosts, and what they're bringing to the table. And this kind of process of like listening and collaborating and working with people, you know, cast and players, brings a richness to the equation that, you know, it's taken me years to learn how to work like this, you know, and to become more humble and listen. And it's really, and I feel like I'm still just kind of learning, you know, but that's just one of the things, I guess, that I've learned.
Do you guys find ever, like, have you ever had anyone where the fear just, like, won? Like, you couldn't, Mr. Nobody couldn't do it, he couldn't fit it in his mouth? Like, through your experience doing the performances, have there been people who have just had to leave because they couldn't handle it? Or do people generally, like, have, you know, I know you said a lot of people have transformational experiences, but have you had people just, like, skidoo because it was too crazy?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't consider myself a miracle worker, a medicine man. I mean, I'm not peddling truth. I don't know the truth. I don't know anybody else's truth. I don't know anybody else's way or path, you know. I'm engaging in these characters and roles in a way that feels good for me and that I think it's having an effect. I know I've touched a lot of people's lives, and I think I've been able to help folks. You know, there's folks that get activated. They get triggered. They think I'm, you know, full of BS. That's okay. That's just part of the path, you know? I mean, yeah, I think any shaman's probably found that as well. It's like you can't heal everybody. I mean, we're doing what we do, and because it's our path. It's my destiny.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about fear because, you know, on the surface, Halloween is a scary time. You know, we allow these things that are potentially frightening into our activity, et cetera, whatever. But if you look around, there's all these ways in which we minimize radically any potential actual sort of encounter with fear, either fear about our own death, fear about the possible existence of ghosts and spooks and devils, the fear of transformation, the fear of having an experience you don't understand. There's all sorts of real fears that lurk in that sort of supernatural folkloric imagery that we associate with Halloween, that we also do everything we can as a culture to kind of keep at bay. So it's like, yeah, we're playing with fear. Maybe we'll go as far as, you know, the equivalent of watching a horror movie where we let ourselves get scared within the very safe confines of watching a film that we know is just a film. But in some ways, we're leaving aside or letting alone the kind of deeper fears that can animate that stuff. And when you talk about fear and the transformative potential of letting go of fear, and you're talking also about personal fears like fear of success and the kinds of fears that hem us in. But those fears are also related to some of these deeper, more existential things. And I don't know. I just want to hear a little bit more about how you have found fear, both supernatural and very ordinary and very personal, fear to be transformative as something that can be really actually confronted, moved through, rather than just sort of avoided or merely toyed with from a distance.
Yeah, you know, my personal journey, because again, I was a very shy child, and part of the reason why I started producing events, because it was the only way I could figure out how to socialize. Like, going to a party would terrify me if I didn't have something to do. I started throwing parties because I found it was an interesting way to sort of have a little bit of control and a buffer and a way to, like, communicate with people on a social level. You know, I know people always find that surprising when they see my characters and my costumes and kind of flamboyant and dandy kind of style, but, you know, I have a very, very private kind of shy side. And that fear, you know, in some ways, I'm a late bloomer, you know, and stepping into my, I don't know, my role in this world, my destiny, or my power, you know, embracing my abilities to be able to produce and lead and direct. You know, I've had incredible fears that have gripped me, and I think my relationship with Mr. Nobody and my allies and my cosplay shamanism, and a lot of it has been me finding ways to give myself permission to embrace these fears or to lean into my fears as, that Buddhist monk woman. I like that phrase, Pema Chodron, or what was her name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But lean into my fears. Like, that phrase was so, I was like, doesn't mean you're embracing it, right? Like, just embrace it. Just get over it. Like, no, nobody wants to be told, just get over it. Just embrace your fear. Like, but lean into it. Like, don't run away from it. How can you lean into it, you know? And so part of the reasons why I love the whimsy and make-believe and puppets and all kinds of fantastical vehicles and forms is because it kind of brings us into a place of, like, wonder and, like, kind of childlike glee. And then from that place, hey, oh, here's the fear. Here's the big scary thing. Maybe you want to take a look at that. What's its name? What's its relationship? How might that be ruling your life? How might that be affecting you? How might that be puppeting you and riding you? Right? You know, so learning how to ask those questions, I've found, has been a real art, because people, you know, fear is like, you don't like, nope, you know? So what are the ways to sort of court people in, you know, tuning into that? And Spookeasy, you know, for me as an artist that wants to create, you know, deeper, more lasting works, Spooky is a way to, like, have a moment, you know, with an audience of 300 adults, where if we can have one moment, we're all kind of identifying something that we're afraid of, and it's really big in our life, and just be like, hey, and, you know, you reach over and you say, hey, what were you afraid of? What's your fear? You know, like, having that moment, I don't know. You know, maybe people can feel like, wow, I feel supported, and, you know, stuff's tough and my life is hard and things are tough in the world, but we've all had this moment where, like, you know what, yeah, we can do this together, you know, and make it fun, you know, celebrate
that
moment.
Well, and it's so interesting psychologically, because so many of those strategies are to kind of depersonalize it, right? Like, even just the brilliance of using the archetype Mr. Nobody to assume the fear, because the reason most of us don't talk about our fears with each other, because we don't want to think that we are bad people or there's something wrong with us. And people will affiliate, like, behaviors or emotions with their identity. So when you identify it as Mr. Nobody and kind of transpersonalize it, then additionally with the group, it's like that is actually what's providing the little slit to open for them to even do that in the first place. Under normal circumstances, their brain would think, oh, I can't talk about this because then everyone's going to know I'm, like, this weak, vulnerable, you know, little creature. So it actually that makes the environment for it to be possible.
It's the beauty of puppetry.
I think another, Another element of that I really took away from what you were just talking about is the way that a lot of people want wonder and enchantment in their lives. They feel their lives are kind of bleak. They turn to all sorts of things, some of them healthy, some of them less healthy, in order to give them that sense of something more, so a greater kind of meaning. What I really took away from what you were saying was how, in a way, if you don't invite fear into the picture, at least as something to lean on, as something to kind of be aware of, is to maybe even go deeper with, it's really hard to get real wonder and real enchantment. And our desire to just have one without the other, I think, is, you know, maybe a little bit misplaced. And that if you really want to, like, see what that desire is about, what does it mean to want enchantment, not just as an entertainment, not just as a way to feel better, but to really understand the potential of being in the world, to confront the world, to participate in the world at a different level, you sort of have to invite, you know, the fears along. And you know, in a way, like, you know, occultism has been sort of like looming in on this conversation without it really being about it. But I do think that one of the reasons that people are attracted to the occult, even young people, even in ways that are very superficial, is because they sense in it a certain combination of fear and wonder, and the sense that there's actually something there, even if it turns out that the real fears are not, you know, fears of spooks or whatever, but, you know, of my own life, of being able to confront the difficulties of ordinary life, or my own limitations and the fears that bind me down, that there's some way that wonder, the combination of wonder and fear, becomes a really powerful kind of medicine.
Yeah.
The
absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
let's see,
we have a
few minutes left. And I wanted to invite you to describe a little bit more of the Mystic Midway Project, which is something I know you've been working on a long time.
Yeah, the Mystic Midway is a world, kind of a mystical carnival world that invites players to explore these themes of persona, exploring selves, exploring your fears, exploring the forces that, you know, work in your life, and having a better understanding. The Mystic Midway itself is based on sort of a card deck of content based of mystical characters, of locations, of concepts. And it's basically distills my work and my understanding of, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about, of the work I've been doing for 25 years. Spookeasy, in a way, is kind of me finding the resources to continue to fund the Mystic Midway as a sort of philanthropic kind of social, like, life as art project. It's gone out on a number of different occasions now. We've showed up at Edwardian Ball. We did the Augmented World Expo a few months ago, and it kind of plays out like an actual, like, set of props and characters that you encounter. You go to Lady Fortuna. We had Mr. Nobody's Swamp Shack, and technologists shared their fears about technology at the Augmented World Expo, and interacted and played and explored. It's very much an ongoing project. It's very much a petri dish, and it teaches me a lot of things, which I'm just bringing straight into Spookeasy. It's mysticmidway.com, ongoing, and it's going to continue to show up, and I'm going to have a card deck that people can facilitate their own midways at home, hopefully soon, and we're going to have a traveling midway of carnival wagons based on bicycles, where we can go out and circle up these bicycle wagons and have these impromptu Mystic Midways appear and encounter people, you know, and just everywhere and anywhere, to take this theater to the marvelous on the road. Yeah, it's ongoing fun.
such a wonderful vision. And I mean, do you feel like there's something particular about our time right now that makes these kinds of new strategies, new performance things that we're seeing things like cosplay or even furries or this whole kind of like there's this sort of something seems to be happening out of a deep cultural need and maybe it has to do with the conditions in that we're facing as a planet, as a civilization, I'm not sure, but it does feel like there's more space for some of these currents to kind of come back in their full life. Do you see that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think a lot of those are all those forces are at play that you mentioned. You know, I mean, as an artist living in San Francisco, in a town that doesn't seem to be supporting the arts much anymore, and venues are closing and people are moving out of the town, I'm forced to evolve. I'm forced to figure out how can I embrace technology and how can I create venue on the go? How can I continue to facilitate deep, crazy, fun, amazing experiences with other, you know, creative folks for anybody, you know, in new, more innovative ways without having to rely on nightclubs and bar guarantees and running a venue? You know, how can I evolve? How can I continue to bring these experiences to people? You know, the corporatization, you know, of cities, we're losing the busking venues like all around the world and not just this country. You know, authorities cracking down, not wanting people to self-organize. You know, we got to get clever. We got to continue to evolve and be creative in how we continue to explore the potential that the arts, that theater, that celebration, you know, of intelligent parties, of, you know, costumed events and, you know, all this kind of stuff has to offer the world.
Yeah, it does seem that there's kind of a little bit of a war going in the sense that at the same time people want livelier urban experiences, they want buskers, they want a kind of breakdown of the festival and of ordinary life, and at the same time there's a lot of forces that want to constrain and control that and kind of make it to be, you know, so you really have to follow all the rules and you have to get the license and all that. It particularly applies to busking and this whole tradition of kind of wandering, very low-level street arts, and it's like people want that stuff, but then it also wants to be controlled, and so that kind of that corporatization
just,
or that control sort of always looming in the wings.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was this article about how this guy is challenging in New York. They still have this freaking cabaret law against, like, dancing in public. Like, it's still used in effect. So, like, if they want to shut anybody down, they're just like, oh, cabaret law, you know. So they have these, like, sneaky restrictions on things like that that are, like, so dumb. And I even remember when I lived in Seattle, it was these dance hall ordinances that literally are these so archaic laws. So there couldn't be, like, underage shows in Seattle, which meant, like, children couldn't see bands. Like, so, or teenagers or whatever. So there's these like regulations that are in place preventing these things are literally so old and come from this different era, and no one is changing them. So it just was really right now there's this dude who's challenging the city of New York because of a cabaret law that was made during Prohibition. So it's very apropos to your time period, you know?
Yeah.
All right, well, we got to wrap it up here. Scott, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yay, no, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. And so folks can check out www.spookeasysf.com to find out more. From me and Majdali out there, keep your minds open.